Hello, friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 68 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I am a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me, of course, is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I am an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
And our mission on Dermasphere is to bring you some of the latest discussions about the latest research in the world of clinical dermatology right to your ears so that you can listen to us instead of having to flip through so many journal articles and such like. And we've got some great articles to discuss today, but before we get into it, I do want to mention that it is almost the end of the year 2021.
What?
And you know what that means.
I'm very excited about this.
The Dermy Awards will be our next episode. So at the end of the calendar year, we give away some awards to articles that we have discussed that we find especially blank. And of course, there's different awards for the different blanks, and it should be a lot of fun. So please join us in 2 weeks for that one.
You can wear formal attire if you like, yes.
Say that again?
I said formal attire, not required, but encouraged.
Oh, very much. And for now, we will discuss a few articles that, who knows, if they play their cards right, they could be featured in this year's Dermy Awards.
Awesome. So today we're having a little bit of a different episode. We're doing sort of interesting articles to us that might not be just out of the past year or two, but are still fairly recent. And this is one that I really like for a lot of reasons. One of them is that it's not from our core literature. And so I always like to reach out and kind of study what's available in the Dermasphere adjacent kind of spheres. So this comes from the ophthosphere, if that makes sense. So here we've also discussed
the plastic sphere, I guess, and yes. Maybe occasionally touched on neurospheres and pedispheres.
The plastosphere. I like that too.
This is the music of the spheres episode.
Yes, exactly. So from the ophthosphere. So this is from the Ophthalmic Plastic Reconstructive Surgery Journal from 2019. And it is an original investigation on doxycycline injection for sclerotherapy of lower eyelid festoons and malar edema, preliminary results by chief authors Cal J. Godfrey and Richard D. Lisman, medical doctors from Weill Cornell Medical College, New England Eye Center, Department of Ophthalmology, and Manhattan Eye, Ear, and Throat Hospital in New York, New York. So lots of wonderful institutions involved in this study. They wanted to investigate the safety and efficacy of direct intralesional doxycycline hyclate injection to improve the appearance of cosmetically significant lower eyelid festoons and malar edema. Now, why, you might ask yourself, would you consider injecting doxycycline into somebody's face?
Yeah, I'm used to giving it to people for acne and a sundry of other dermatologic concerns.
I find it to be a very useful antibiotic. This is a very interesting study trying to address a very difficult problem. So lower eyelid festoons and malar edema can present as just sort of a natural consequence of aging. It can also happen because of previous surgical procedures and even aesthetic treatments. It's actually one of the dreaded complications of lower eyelid filler in attempts to correct the lower eyelid kind of tear trough deformities.
Michelle, before we go on, what's a festoon?
A festoon. So a festoon is anything that sort of kind of pouches down from two attachment points. Festal garlands are a nice example of this. So if you've ever like draped fabric, the festoon is the little swath in between the two anchoring points, which is sort of what's happening with a lower eyelid festoon because there are two attachment points anatomically, which are the orbital retaining ligament and the orbitozygomatic ligament.
So that bell is not a festoon. It's the crimping bell, but it makes a nice festoon.
It's festive.
That was a reach. So any material that is especially pimpable or testable, we like to ring the bell. So a festoon is like a hammock. So if people are talking about like their lower eyelid bags or they have baggy eyelids, I guess the medical term is a festoon. And if they look especially funny, it's a loony festoon.
There may have been some loony festoons in here. Some of them were unilateral, so that's possible. So these are things, like I said, that can happen just normally. They can happen after facial surgery. They can happen as a consequence of chronic allergies or chronic sinusitis. And they can happen after hyaluronic acid filler because it is very osmotically active and can attract fluid as it's quite hygroscopic. So all of these things can exaggerate or exacerbate patients that have a genetic predisposition to the formation of these festoons. And they are very difficult to treat. Now, they appropriately point out that these also may be a finding in patients who have some kind of underlying medical disorder. So you'll see these if you ever take care of patients that have congestive heart failure. Very frequently, they're going to have an exaggeration of their festoons. Patient can have worsening of festoons and acute allergy exacerbations. They can also have them after any procedure that causes facial edema. But in the absence of identifiable etiology, they're often idiopathic, and they're always pretty irritating to the patient. They can be quite cosmetically concerning because they kind of make people look like a hound dog. It's a sort of fatigued and aged look that's not cosmetically desirable. They can be treated surgically or non-surgically. Non-surgical treatments can include injections of tetracycline, hyaluronidase, deoxycholic acid, which sounds very brave, laser, chemical peels, and oral diuretics. There can also be surgical treatments such as direct excision, which some people do, and the lower eyelids can heal very well. So in a properly selected patient, that could be a nice cosmetic outcome. You can also do lower eyelid blepharoplasty, which is kind of a significant surgery, but can give great results. Mid-facial lifts, as well as the release of the orbicularis retaining ligament. All of these are surgical approaches. These can be efficacious, but they can have underlying risks, and they can also potentially be technically challenging to do or administer. So they wanted to find something that might be a little bit more accessible to treat. So they looked at the kind of contributions of dermal laxity and lymphatic stasis to the malar edema and festoons, and thought about the possibility of treatments that might obliterate the potential space for lymphatic fluid accumulation. Comes to the table now with doxycycline hyclate, which is an antibiotic we are quite familiar with in the derm sphere, in the dermosphere, in the derm world. It's in the tetracycline family, and it can be used as a sclerosing agent for fluid cavities throughout the body. So one of its surgical uses is to sclerose cavities that have formed in the abdominal lymphatic malformations, subcutaneous swellings of closed skin degloving injuries, as well as potentially other fluid accumulations.
So this could also touch in the world of pediatric dermatology since we deal with vascular anomalies. So I am not a vascular anomalies expert, and we rely on our interventional radiology colleagues to do the sclerosing, but doxycycline apparently is something they can use to sclerose down some lymphatic malformations.
And tetracycline has been reported to be beneficial in the past in the ophthalmologic literature for this problem as well, but doxycycline is readily available in intravenous form and can be reconstituted in the office and injected off-label, making it a little bit simpler to do. Because when tetracycline was used, they were actually opening tetracycline capsules and filtering the drug inside the capsule to prepare it for injection, which sounds very fraught and complicated. It also limited the utility of the product to about 2 hours after preparation, whereas the doxycycline hyclate suspension, once put together, could be used for up to 48 hours with proper refrigeration. So they thought it might be very useful and beneficial to try. So they looked into this as a sort of retrospective study. They looked at 15 consecutive patients with malar edema or festoons that had been injected with doxycycline hyclate, specifically at the concentration of 10 milligrams per milliliter, who had pre- and post-injection photographs that were able to then be reviewed and graded on a scale of 0 to 3, 0 being no festoon, 1 being a small festoon, 2 a medium festoon, and 3 a large festoon. These were rated by 2 masked physician observers. They were excluded if they did not have the right concentration of injected doxycycline or had incomplete photographic records, or if they did not have any follow-up. They were able to find 11 patients to meet their criteria, so they had 20 consecutive treatment areas because they kind of evaluated each side independently. Their final follow-up ranged from 3 to 104 weeks with a mean follow-up of 22.5 weeks. And their standard deviation of their initial festoon was about 2.5, so between moderate and large. And that was able to be decreased to 0.9, so that was down to a small festoon with a p-value of less than 0.001. So statistically significant improvement to a much more desirable cosmetic outcome. The average number of injections per side was 1.4 with a range of 1 to 2. So some patients had one injection, some had two. No patients had more than that. The mean volume per injection was 0.72 milliliters. That ranged from 0.15 to 2.0 milliliters, and commonly documented subjective complaints were burning sensation with injection, bruising, pain, erythema. But importantly, there were no dermatologic or visual complications following treatment, which I think is quite important when you're talking about injecting things near the eye. Now, talking about how these injections were performed, some of the patients were injected in clinic and some of them were injected in the operating room with IV sedation. They put together the doxycycline hyclate 100 milligram sterile powder that was lyophilized and diluted with normal saline, so 0.9% bacteriostatic sodium chloride solution, to that concentration of 10 milligrams per milliliter. And that was refrigerated and used within 48 hours of reconstitution. It was protected from any exogenous forces, no sunlight or extremes of heat. They did the injections with a 1 milliliter syringe with 30 gauge needle directly into the vastum or the area of the malar edema. And they used multiple planes, subcutaneous, intramuscular, as well as throughout the lesion. The volume of injection was guided by the size of the festoon, so larger lesions had larger injection volumes. Repeat injections were done as needed for residual edema after an observation of 3 to 6 months. So that 3 to 6 month observation period they thought was quite important. And they had the treatment bilaterally in 9 cases and unilaterally in 2 of the cases. 6 of them were in the office, 5 were in the operating room. The patients who were awake, the 100% of these 6 patients who are treated without sedation reported burning pain, so uniform pain with this procedure, that resolved completely prior to leaving the office and lasted anywhere from 2 to 10 minutes with an average of 7 minutes of burning pain. So you have to have a motivated patient for this. Skin redness was appreciated in 3 patients with a duration of about 2 days. Bruising was reported in 7 patients lasting an average of 10 days. It was nothing else significant was seen. They had no problems with visual complications, no problems with vision loss or ocular surface abnormalities, skin necrosis, numbness, or ischemia, which I think is very important, again, when you were talking about injecting things near the eyes. So the contributions of dermal laxity, lymphatic stasis, and malar edema and festoons are potentially amenable to treatments that obliterate this potential space for the lymphatic fluid to accumulate. The premise for using the doxycycline was basically building on the success of other physicians, Perry et al., who had used tetracycline in 2015 for lower eyelid festoons. And that work was building on the successful report of intralesional tetracycline for the treatment of chronic bulbar chemosis following eyelid surgery. And those suggested safety and promising patient outcomes. But again, that reconstitution of the tetracycline involved taking the oral capsule and then filtering the contents of that for injection, leaving only 2 hours of a usable product that would usually constitute a barrier for use in most patients. So they really liked the option of using the doxycycline, and they proposed some different options for why it might be beneficial.
But we don't know exactly why it works as a sclerosing agent, as I recall.
Yeah, so they don't really know why it's beneficial, but they have different attributions, including the inhibition of matrix metalloproteinase, cell proliferation and suppression of vascular endothelial growth factor, VEGF. It's also been demonstrated to induce collagen and fibrin deposition, creating dense adhesions and fibrosis in areas of injection and other uses. So that might help to improve the turgor as well as attachment points and decrease that potential space for swelling. It's been cited in the literature as treatment for various fluid-filled lesions throughout the body, including malignant pleural effusions, and also has been used as a sclerotherapeutic, which I like that, sclerotherapeutic, for the treatment of postoperative lymphoceles, low-flow venous malformations, and lymphangiomas in the abdomen, head and neck, and closed skin degloving injuries. Also potentially useful for lymphatic malformations in children, and has been used as an effective treatment as an oral medicine for the treatment of blepharochalasis, because of the inhibition of matrix metalloproteinase. So that's nice. Let's see here. They postulate that other things may potentially improve the efficacy of this treatment in future studies, including the use of post-treatment compression following the injections, as well as experimenting reconstituting the doxycycline with lidocaine to improve patient comfort. They point out that previous studies that have looked at festoons and treatments with the tetracycline have shown relatively similar results and a similar trend towards using volumes relating to the size of the festoon. They also noted that there was an important waiting period in between treatments, and they wanted to emphasize that doxycycline's treatment effects may take several months, so repeat injections should not be performed prior to 3 months because they need to allow for the full treatment cycle to sort of go through its process, and that repeat treatments should be delayed until that 3-month time and only performed when necessary. There is there are a few studies in the literature that reported possible evidence about doxycycline and neurotoxicity. This was a 1996 study where rat femoral nerves, which were exposed directly to doxycycline, demonstrated histopathologic changes, but no physiologic evidence of neurotoxicity. Those have never been replicated. And there have been other studies that look at intracerebral doxycycline and tetracycline for neuroprotective properties in prion disease, as well as doxycycline as a neuroprotective element in our animal model of Parkinson's disease. So there's not compelling evidence that doxycycline is neurotoxic, but of course they always want to proceed with caution and avoid any injection near to a neurovascular bundle. They had, of course, the normal limitations of a retrospective study, non-standard timing, relatively small patient population, as well as, I thought this was very salient to point out, non-standard timing of photography to account for diurnal variation of edema, because patients might have different levels of edema in these festoons or malar edema areas, depending on the time of day. But I think it's a potential promising treatment and could potentially give us a new way to attack this challenging and frustrating problem.
So doxycycline's pretty cheap, so this is kind of a nice cosmetic option. Have you ever performed this, Michelle?
I have not used doxycycline. I've used hyaluronidase successfully for patients who have festoons, and in the right patient, it can make a nice difference. I think that the doxycycline may have several potential benefits over the hyaluronidase, including the ability to induce neocollagenesis and fibrosis, because so much of the time you actually have a multiply leveled problem where there's tissue laxity as well as edema, as well as patient characteristics that sort of predispose them to this deformity. And doxycycline seems to be able to address more of those than the hyaluronidase can.
Michelle, how do you like to listen to podcasts? What kind of headphones do you use?
I to my chagrin, I do like to use AirPods, which I am an expert at losing. It is very embarrassing how many pairs of those things I've already gone through.
You can like set your phone up to be able to ping them or something.
That's what I understand, and I'm trying to figure that out, but I think they have to be charged, and usually by the time I've figured out that I've lost them, they're already dead, so.
Well, I also listen to AirPods, hashtag not sponsored, and it's a good bet that some of you guys listening right now are listening to AirPods, because apparently they're the best-selling Bluetooth headphone on the market. But according to our next study, they can give you allergic contact dermatitis.
Sad.
The title is Contact Allergy to Acrylates in Apple AirPods Pro Headphones, a case series, out of the International Journal of Dermatology from November 2021. The authors include Rob Shaver and Anne Neely out of Minnesota. So this is a small case series of 4 patients, each with patch test proven allergic contact dermatitis to AirPods, specifically to acrylates or methacrylates in AirPods. The specific material is unclear, but it's probably a proprietary acrylate within the product. And there are some convincing photographs in here that show actual pieces of the AirPods taped to people's skin and showing a reaction. So if you or one of your patients is having a lot of ear dermatitis, you might think about something like this. The authors point out that acrylates are composed, among other things, of acrylic monomers. And an acrylic monomer is a potent sensitizer, but most of the acrylic monomers are gone during the manufacturing process. However, you might have some left over due to incomplete polymerization. So acrylic monomers have to be put together in a big old chain, which is, of course, called a polymer. The act of putting them into a chain is called polymerization. And due to incomplete polymerization, some acrylic monomers may still be wandering around and can sensitize people to acrylates. But the likelihood of developing an allergy to sort of complete or cured acrylates and methacrylates is very low. And according to Apple, AirPods may contain trace amounts of acrylates from adhesives. So one thought is that the adhesives within the AirPods can sort of trickle out or make you give you the sensitization so that you react then to the acrylates that are in more of the product. And this, so there's a lot of different ways that I find articles to talk about on Dermasphere. And one of the ways is I subscribe to this sort of digest, which does the work for me, I guess. And various dermatologists say, hey, maybe this would be an article of interest. And then they can also write a little commentary about what they think of the article or something like that. So Dr. Ashish Bhatia picked this one and had one comment that he has also had a patient with allergic contact dermatitis to AirPods, but the offending portion was not the plastic bit itself, but the soft removable earpiece. And the patient did not want to undergo patch testing, but did replace the removable earpiece with an aftermarket memory foam earpiece, which resolved the issue. Well, so you can consider that as well. That's short, but that's it. I think it's helpful to know that people can develop allergic contact dermatitis to their AirPods and presumably to other forms of headphones and earphones that they might be using. So tell them to listen to Dermosphere or Skincast, but to do so without headphones that cause them allergic contact dermatitis.
All right. Well, you know, it would be useful to cover up your allergic contact dermatitis from your AirPods, Luke.
Long Fabio-like hair.
Lots of hair, right? So if anybody's a regular listener to this podcast, y'all know that I am a big hair nerd. I love hair. I think hair science is fascinating. I think it is a microcosm for all of human organogenesis and things like that. Major hair nerd. So I love any kind of article that talks about things that are potential treatment for hair loss. So here we have a lovely article out of the American Society for Dermatologic Surgery Journal in 2019 covering platelet-rich plasma as a treatment for androgenetic alopecia by chief authors Adita Gupta and Carlos J. Puig. There are no significant conflicts of interest reported for this article. Platelet-rich plasma is a treatment that can be used for a lot of types of regenerative medicine. It's created by concentrating platelets found in whole blood, and it can aid in tissue regeneration, bone regeneration, and wound repair. Some of its first applications were actually in the orthopedic literature where they were utilizing it to help improve the repair of things such as meniscus tears, things like that.
So if I was somebody who wanted to get a platelet-rich plasma treatment for something, I would go into an office, they would draw my blood, and then while I waited around, they would like centrifuge it, and then that would separate it into various layers, including a layer that's called platelet-rich plasma. And in addition to being rich in platelets, it's apparently rich in a bunch of juicy growth factors and other such things that are thought to do various beneficial voodoo to the rest of your cells.
So that's a very nice kind of concise description of how it's used. So it has been suggested to use for an agent to promote hair growth and encourage cell survival and proliferation, potentially also to prolong the anagen phase of the hair cycle. It is thought to exert its effect on the treatment of androgenetic alopecia by delivering growth factors to the hair follicle and surrounding area. And a lot of patients really like platelet-rich plasma because it's basically their body's own healing capacity being used to help heal a medical issue. So patients who are a little bit more on the natural side of things, my crunchy granola patients and such, do tend to like the idea of platelet-rich plasma. The major side effect of PRP is that it's expensive. So it ranges in cost from $300 to $700 for treatment, and it can be difficult to perform.
Why is it expensive? I already have my own blood. I bring it with me.
Right? So a lot of the systems that are used to harvest the platelet-rich plasma, the container that is used to kind of separate out the plasma and prepare it, can cost anywhere from like $100 to $200. The system I personally use costs about $150, I think, per tube. And so that's a consumable that increases the cost of the treatment. Some people do use regular kind of blood drawing tubes that you would use just, you know, for labs. And some people do report that they get efficacy with that, but studies utilizing those specific sort of lower priced systems are a little bit less represented in the literature, possibly because there's not a commercial entity supporting those studies. That would be an interesting thing to do as an aside. But the emerging evidence is starting to characterize the dermal and follicular response to several growth factors, including platelet-derived growth factor, transforming growth factor beta, and others. So this study wanted to assess the effectiveness of PRP as a monotherapy and adjunct treatment for male androgenetic alopecia. And I do think that this is one of the ways you kind of have to do studies is you have to limit other influencing parameters so much as possible so that you get some decrease in the heterogeneity of the data that you're looking at, especially when you're attempting a meta-analysis as these authors are. Now, that being said, I will say as a person who treats hair loss that I do find it to be more efficacious in combination with other agents, including low-dose oral minoxidil therapy, some kind of androgen blocking therapy, low-level laser light therapy, potentially microneedling and other treatments. This was patients that were only treated with PRP, and it was only male patients with androgenetic alopecia. There's also been benefit demonstrated with platelet-rich plasma for other types of alopecia, including alopecia areata, and some inflammatory types of alopecia, including frontal fibrosing alopecia, and there's been benefit demonstrated in both male and female patients, but this was a well-done meta-analysis in a homogeneous, as homogeneous of a patient population as they could get. So male patients with androgenetic alopecia on monotherapy with platelet-rich plasma. So they wanted to look at this. They did this meta-analysis and looked at something called the standardized mean difference, which is a measurement of basically the difference of the patients before and after treatment. So this was able to be utilized as a measure of effect size, treatment versus comparator results with like placebo. If you had the standard mean difference close to zero, that suggests no difference, and increasingly higher scores are associated with improvement. Heterogeneity was also evaluated through their statistical analysis, and they set their p-value at less than 0.5 for significance. So they were able to find a standard mean difference in hair density of 0.58 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.35 to 0.80, so it didn't get close to zero, which is demonstration of a positive effect in favor of PRP treatment in this patient population. A couple of interesting things that they go through in this article that I really liked was potentially why this might work. So what's in the platelet-rich plasma? How is it prepared and how can it be beneficial?
I believe I already mentioned voodoo.
Okay, that sounds funny, but there is a little bit of voodoo that goes into treating hair loss patients. There are some hair loss patients that if you look at them sideways and say, you know, this is going to cause your hair to grow, and they take it, they're going to get hair growth. There are also hair loss patients where you tell them, and this is a problem with hair loss drugs, because every hair loss drug that's useful for hair loss treatment has listed as a side effect hair loss, because patients that lose hair, okay? And they're paying attention to it. So any drug that we use to treat hair loss has hair loss listed as a side effect. There is also a population of patients that if you gave them a sugar pill and said, this is going to cause hair loss, they would get hair loss just because they thought they were going to get hair loss. There is definitely a huge placebo and a huge nocebo effect when you're talking about treating alopecia, especially telogen effluvium.
It's a hairy situation.
I was waiting for one of those puns, so I'm kind of glad you did it. I was like, when's it going to happen? The suspense is killing me. Anyway,
well, I'm glad you just put it out there as a nice bald statement.
So the way this is done, you take the blood, you centrifuge it, you draw off some volume of platelet poor plasma that varies per system, and what's left behind is the platelet rich plasma. The system I'm accustomed to using is the Eclipse system. I don't have any sponsorship of that. That's just the one that my clinic uses. The way that that's done is relatively simple. So you centrifuge, you draw off the platelet poor plasma, and then this is important. You do have to gently agitate the tube to wash the platelets off the gel so that you're not leaving all of the what you really want kind of on the gel that you then throw in the trash. The Sharps container, of course, because it's glass. But the things that are contained within the platelet-rich plasma include epidermal growth factor, beta-catenin, insulin-like growth factor 1, TGF-beta, as well as FGF7, which inhibits bone morphogenic protein 2, and VEGF, which promotes angiogenesis. And we know that a lot of the things that help us to grow hair have some effect on circulation to the hair follicles. That's how we think that minoxidil helps us. That's also how we know that scalp massage and other means that improve circulation to the scalp improve hair growth. We also know that things that change blood flow to the scalp can cause patients to lose hair. So constrictive hair headwear can actually cause hair loss. Patients have been treated with Botox that may potentially improve circulation to the hair by relaxing vascular structures and muscles that are ancillary to the scalp. That might have something to do with it. And some patients present with hair loss following treatment with beta blockers. So there's a lot of vascular game in the hair growth arena. So this, I think, was a very nicely done study. What they found was that patients had the best improvement when they were treated initially at monthly intervals with 3 repeated treatments, so 3 months in a row, with maintenance therapy ranging between 3 to 6 months, and that patients were able to improve best whenever the PRP was injected earlier on in their course of alopecia. And patients that had a lower grade of alopecia at baseline were more likely to respond, and younger patients responded better as well, which is, I think, consistent with what we would see in any clinical study. The longer alopecia sits and, you know, entrenches itself, the harder it becomes to treat. And the more the hair follicles have gone through the process of miniaturization, eventually there is a point of no return. So when you see a gentleman with a shiny bald scalp where you can't even perceive any follicular structures or openings, the likelihood of that patient having successful treatment is much lower than a patient that still has a lot of vellus hairs or has a lot of hairs that are still in an intermediate state where they're able to be rescued.
Patrick Stewart's hair is not coming back.
No, but he's so handsome the way he is. I wouldn't change Patrick Stewart for the world. He's a handsome gentleman. So he's like a nice, you know, role model for gentlemen of the follicular deprivation arena. So big question that was raised is, do you have to activate platelet-rich plasma? And there are hair experts on both sides of this divide. Some people swear by activation of the platelet-rich plasma using calcium chloride or calcium gluconate to induce the alpha granule release of growth factors from platelets. Other hair loss experts say that when the platelet-rich plasma comes in contact with the dermal fibroblasts, it goes, this is what I'm supposed to do, this is what I'm made for, this is my job, and it discharges its granules just as well as it would if you activated it.
All these mystical growth factors and platelets are within these alpha granules, so they have to be released or activated. So can your own body do it, or do you have to do it with calcium gluconate?
Yeah. And some people feel like the scalp needling itself, which is used as you're introducing the platelet-rich plasma into the scalp with the injections, which are done with a varying array of needles. Some people using 20 gauges, which I'm like, oof, that sounds mean, all the way down to 32 gauges. With a 30 gauge being the most commonly used. That's what I use. I use the 30 gauge. But most people feel that the PRP is able to be activated in the scalp. And if you actually perform these injections, you see it happen. So the scalp begins to flush as you're injecting the PRP endogenously without activation. The system I use doesn't require activation. It's the Eclipse system. And I see the activity of the platelets by its vasoactive amine release occurring in the scalp during the injection. It's unknown if needle size influences the efficacy of PRP. Most experts agree that the particles we're trying to get through are small enough that a 30-gauge needle is fully sufficient. Some people use a 27-gauge purely for flow characteristics because it's easier to inject through a larger bore needle. There are other questions as, if there's presence of other blood components, does that impact the efficacy of the treatment, including if there's any impact of white blood cells, neutrophils, or red blood cells. Generally, red blood cells are not desirable in PRP because that can increase the discomfort of injection for the patients. Most people are trying to go for more of a kind of straw-colored injectant than more of a rosé-colored injectant, although sometimes you do get some red blood cells suspended in your PRP, and it doesn't really seem to decrease the efficacy in my personal practice. But natural contact through dermal fibroblasts with PRP can certainly allow for the elaboration of these vasoactive and proliferative mediators. Some other kind of studies that they did were looking into the impact of sonication of the preparation. If sort of agitating the injectant through a sonicator prior to injection would optimize therapy, there's some minor indications that might be beneficial, but it requires further study. So I think, you know, good evidence that it can be beneficial, good foundational principles as to why it might be useful. And of course, we still have lots to learn about this.
So this is something that you do.
Mm-hmm.
And you said it costs something like $400 to $500 per injection?
In my practice, because I'm in a sort of hardworking farming community, down-to-earth type of people, our market, I don't think, would bear the higher cost. So our injections are $300 per treatment. Some centers charge up to $700 per treatment.
And these guys have a specific protocol they set out, right? They say try it monthly for 3 months and then like every 3 months for, So they say 3 monthly sessions and then a 3 to 6 month maintenance interval, and then follow up to see if they need some more, I guess.
Yeah, basically follow up yearly at that point, which, you know, I find that patients tend to need to have a kind of maintenance injection every 6 months or so when they get good results. And I don't think that that's an excessive thing. You know, it's like getting your teeth cleaned. It's a maintenance of a tissue. And
no, it really doesn't sound too bad. Like if 3 monthly injections for $400 to $600 plus then do that twice a year thereafter forever can prevent or recover my male pattern hair loss, I can see a lot of people going for that rather than taking finasteride and minoxidil every day. So I'm a little bit surprised that I don't see this more often. Maybe people just don't have the equipment in their office to do it.
Well, and there's heterogeneity between systems as well. So they listed all of the different systems that were available commercially. There are even more systems available commercially now. And the systems change over time because of proprietary technology and sometimes supply chain. So I think that sometimes the heterogeneity of the results can be attributable to the variety of systems. The other problem is that you're treating a heterogeneous group of patients. So the later you get the patient in the course of their disease, the more progressed it is, the more end stage it is, the less likely you are to get response. But the people who have finally made the decision to do something big about the hair loss often are at that more end stage. So I think that kind of educating the populace about treating it early, catching it early, and trying to do those interventions at a price point and at a distribution that's more accessible is potentially a way to improve success.
Since you're injecting the patient's own platelet-rich plasma back into their dermis, I assume that there's not a lot of adverse effects?
Not a whole lot. Usually it's some burning, stinging, or itching at the site of injection. Of course, bruising is a possibility. Anytime you break the skin, there can be bleeding or infection. The big concern in areas that have a high throughput clinic is just being meticulous with ensuring that the patient's own plasma is what's getting reinjected and being very careful about your cleanliness so that there's no, you know, unwanted transmission of any disease agent, because that would be catastrophic.
Well, it's fairly convincing. It makes me like want to do it for some of my patients, though only about 30% of my patients are adults in the first place. So I don't really have a lot of people with androgenetic alopecia. My main concern is that if I approached my department and said, hey, I want to do this, that I would suddenly be the hair guy and they would all be coming to me. And I'm not sure I want to narrow my practice that much. But still, it's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a really neat treatment regimen. We also use PRP for rejuvenation. It can be beneficial to improve kind of photo aging. It can be used both through injection as well as through microneedling for texture and fine lines. And many people, including myself, have found it beneficial for early under eye hollowness in young female patients.
Well, I have to admit I'm not interested in using it personally for that stuff. Except for having it done on me so I can maintain my youthful good looks. But I have a lot more patients with acne than androgenetic alopecia, and I treat a lot of them with isotretinoin. Michelle, I'm sure you also have patients on isotretinoin, also called Accutane. What do you do for laboratory monitoring?
So this is a topic, I think, of increasing discussion. I do think that it is a smart idea to get baseline labs, just because a lot of the patients we treat with Accutane, isotretinoin, are young, healthy patients who may not have pre-existing lab work. And you don't want to be the person that, you know, runs into somebody with idiopathic thrombocytopenia and somebody think it's because of the medication you prescribe. Or you find somebody with a previously undiagnosed liver disease and that somehow gets blamed on you. So I think that doing the preliminary lab work is just a good baseline check to make sure, first of all, there's no underlying medical issue. Other inflammatory conditions can accompany severe acne. So I think that's prudent, but also that you're able to measure distance from their baseline. So I usually do a baseline lab, and then I try to get them close to their goal dose in young patients. This is very different with adult patients, specifically because of the triglyceride component. So I would say that 1 in 50 to 1 in 100 of my patients between the ages of like 12 and 20, which is where I usually am treating patients with Accutane, will have any lipid abnormalities. But once you get into the 30s and older, the propensity for hypertriglyceridemia is much more significant. And so I think that you have to be a little bit more cautious in that patient population.
So you do like baseline CBC and CMP and lipids on everybody?
If they don't have pre-existing labs, yes.
And then how frequently do you follow up lipids primarily?
In young patients that are otherwise well, that have normal baseline labs, I'm usually checking their results once I get them close to their goal dose. But in adult patients, I usually check until we get to the goal dose, and then we just sort of monitor clinically.
And you check just lipids, or do you check LFTs and stuff as well?
Just lipids, typically, unless there's abnormalities otherwise.
So it's interesting how different people are with their isotretinoin labs. So I generally don't check baseline labs because I feel like they're always normal anyways, because I'm treating a healthy 14-year-old. And then I tend to check ALT and triglycerides only about 2 months into their course, because at that point they've usually received a month's Accutane at their goal dose, because they usually start out at, like, you know, 40 mgs per kg per day, and then, or 40 milligrams per day, and then increase it to 40 twice a day after a month, for example. And I so rarely find any problems, and when I do, it like goes away on recheck or whatever. So I started wondering why we bother checking anything at all. And in the pandemic world, I've been, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, I was telling the families, you know, the standard is sort of to check labs here, but I've been having more of a discussion lately with families to save them another contact with the medical system because of the pandemic. Do you guys want to do labs? And a lot of them have had said no, and nothing horrible has happened, knock on wood. But then I started wondering why I just take ALT and triglycerides. And when people ask me, I say, well, I once read an article that said that's all I needed. And then I thought, maybe I should talk about that article on Dermosphere. So I tried to find it, and I found this one. I'm not 100% sure this is the one, but it may have been. Or maybe I somehow synthesized a bunch of articles in my head. Anywho, this is still a good one. It's called Standardized Laboratory Monitoring with Use of Isotretinoin in Acne. It's from the JAAD from 2018. Authors include Tim Hansen and Andrea Zangline. These are people out of Penn State. And this is a review of lab results from over 500 patients who underwent a total of 574 courses of isotretinoin over the years. They point out that lab abnormalities in general were pretty inconsequential, and the most common by far were lipid abnormalities. So they're eventual recommendations after they go through it all is they say you should check LFTs and lipids at baseline and at 2 months into the course, and that's it. They recommend against checking CBC, Michelle, so perhaps you would be convinced to change your practice.
You know, the reason I'll tell you is that I had a patient I didn't do that in who had idiopathic thrombocytopenia that had been undiagnosed. And the patient's mother was losing her mind over it until we found labs by the sheer grace of God from a pediatrician years prior that showed the same platelet levels. So that's
so medical-legal reasons.
Yeah.
Our reason, I'm not sure they're the best reason to do stuff.
They're not.
They're real. They say routine monitoring of a CBC is unwarranted as abnormal values tend to resolve or remain stable despite continued therapy. And they say post-infectious and benign ethnic neutropenia are common causes of these abnormalities in otherwise healthy adolescents. But I hear where you're coming from. Maybe it would be worth knowing if your patient had one of those things, especially one that wasn't transient before you started it. At this institution, so at Penn State here, they checked. So their liver panel for this included only ALT and not AST because it's more organ specific than AST. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably where I pulled, we just need ALT. And they also checked total cholesterol and triglycerides. And they were checking white blood cells and platelets at the time as well, so they ended up deciding they didn't need to do that. So transaminitis, they say, was not significantly increased compared with baseline detection rates, 1.9% versus 1.6% at baseline. They say that, though they also have a passage in here where they say that ALT elevations were found during 19 courses of isotretinoin, which is 3% of them. The most severe occurred 2 months into treatment in a male patient who had just begun a new vitamin supplement with his ALT peaking at 264. He stopped the vitamin supplement, his dose of isotretinoin was halved, and his ALT normalized within a month. So was it this vitamin supplement? Was it the isotretinoin? Was it the two of them together? No one will ever know. Other items to consider. So this is interesting. Mild to moderate ALT elevations can be detected in up to 9% of just people. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to some hepatologists about this stuff before, like when I find an you know, an abnormality that's like 1.5 to 2 times the upper limit of normal. And I'm like, what the heck am I supposed to do about this? And they've told me that ALT and AST values like fluctuate more than other laboratory values. And so you can just catch people on kind of an off day and find it abnormal. They also point out that, of course, fatty liver, which is a result of obesity and alcohol intake, can cause elevated levels. So, of course, if you get somebody who has elevation, you ask them about that stuff and NSAIDs and so on. They do point out that several decades, so isotretinoin, by the way, was approved for acne in 1982. So we've been using it for a long time, and there have been no reports of irreversible hepatic sequelae from the use of isotretinoin. And they point out that NSAIDs and antibiotics account for the majority of drug-induced liver injuries. And we don't tell people to monitor their liver labs when they take that stuff. So I'm starting to wondering why we're monitoring anything in Accutane. So I do check ALT, but I feel like, you know, and they come out recommending LFTs. But based on this discussion, I wonder if they feel as I do that maybe we should just not do it. Let's talk about lipids. Mm-hmm. So they do say that significant elevations occurred with triglycerides and cholesterol, both in about 20% of people, or 20% of courses, which is a fair amount, but they weren't bad. The most severe abnormalities were grade 2, which is like mild. And they also say that baseline abnormalities were frequent. So baseline hypercholesterolemia comprised 40% of the people who were eventually abnormal, and hypertriglyceridemia, that number was 31%. The max cholesterol level in any patient was 325. Triglyceride elevations, they had one patient who had a 972 triglycerides, which is pretty high, so normal is probably like, what, 150 to 200 or so? In a 46-year-old man, he had both acne and hidradenitis suppurativa, and he had been taking isotretinoin for 9 months. They do point out that a grade 2 triglyceride level was occurred in one patient at baseline and 7 patients over the course of treatment. 6 of them had grade 1 elevations at baseline. They do point out that fasting prior to testing was not required by all providers. So some of the elevations may have been just due to people eating before they had their labs drawn. And I tell people, I don't like to not eat. I'm assuming other people are the same as me. So I tell them, you don't have to be fasting, but the labs are a little bit more accurate if you do. And then, you know, when I do check, if I do find a vastly abnormal triglyceride, I repeat it fasting, of course. But they say that no patients with mild to moderate elevations discontinued isotretinoin. They don't say that it affected their course. Maybe their doctor, you know, halved their dose and monitored triglyceride levels or something. But I feel like we're not actually doing anything even when we find abnormalities. So why are we checking? So one reason is perhaps because of pancreatitis. Mm-hmm. Well, pancreatitis caused by isotretinoin may not actually happen. There have only been like 11 reports. And in those patients, it wasn't triggered by hypertriglyceridemia anyway. All of their triglyceride levels were normal. Plus, the pancreatitis was not caused by routine laboratory monitoring. It was caused by people having crippling abdominal pain and symptoms of pancreatitis. So the labs can't catch it anyway. Still, the authors of this paper say that patients with significantly abnormal triglyceride levels trending upward should be regularly monitored and dose adjustments made before pancreatitis occurs. That seems quite conservative based on their data and their discussion, but for medical legal reasons, we have to be conservative in some cases. Finally, lab abnormalities in general in their patients surfaced around days 50 to 60, which was probably due to many providers' technique of starting low and increasing after months, just like I do, which is why they recommend checking at 2 months.
So one of my favorite pimping questions with Accutane is, when does the risk of acute pancreatitis kind of begin? Like, what's the lowest level that you would be worried about? So what do you think that number is?
In terms of triglyceridemia?
Yeah.
It's high, like 2,000?
The risk actually begins with levels over 500. The risk increases markedly over 1,000. So the risk of acute pancreatitis is about 5% with serum triglycerides of greater than 1,000. And then it gets up to 10 to 20% with greater than 2,000. Then it goes up kind of almost linearly from there. So that's the thing that I worry about more in adult patients, just because they do tend to have other bad habits as well sometimes that might predispose them to the possibility of pancreatitis, as well as having lived with their pancreas for a longer period of time and possibly having pre-existing structural disease. But it
well,
is a big question.
And then I hear what you're saying. I also feel like their points of, you know, these other drugs are probably more dangerous and we don't monitor them is also valid.
I think so too. And, you know, I think one other thing we do have to think about in the era of the pandemic is that I don't know if you guys are affected by this, but we've had a shortage of blood draw tubes. So we've had to sort of de facto modify some of our laboratory checking, which is already milder than I think a lot of centers are in terms of the, you know, frequency of laboratory checks. But we've had trouble with patients not necessarily being able to get the blood drawn at the first lab they go to.
Yeah, we've been rerouting a lot of the blood draw tubes from Lubbock to our institution so that we make sure we have enough.
Come on, man. Utah.
So I feel like we should have some kind of study about why the heck are we doing isotretinoin labs at all. I know everybody, well, not me yet, knock on wood, has the story of everything seemed fine in this otherwise healthy 16-year-old girl, but then I checked labs and her triglycerides were through the roof. But is that really from isotretinoin? And like, what's the number needed to treat and the cost benefit and blah, blah, blah. So I have the discussion with the families generally these days, especially in my young, healthy adolescents. For adults, especially if they're overweight or something, then I do check. But I feel like maybe to be to avoid medical waste or be more cost effective or whatever you want to call it, we can re-examine our isotretinoin laboratory checking plans.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, very reasonable always to not just do things because it's the way we've always done them. You also do sometimes have to worry, though, about what the standard of care is and the fact that you'll be compared to that if there was an adverse medical outcome. So it's always a balancing act.
That's why I discuss it with the family, so I can at least document that. But you've been in practice longer than I have, so you probably have had to deal with that kind of stuff more frequently than I. So maybe when I'm old and crotchety like Dr. Tarbox, I'll change the way I do things. With great eyelid festoons.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Oh, man. So I guess I have an article now. Are we moving on or are we?
Yeah, I think I'm done with the soapbox. I'll put it in the recycling bin.
Okay. I do recycle. I think recycling is appropriate. So talking now, I'm trying to make a connection here. Nope. Well, you could use a box to make a picture frame. And frame sounds like frame. That was terrible. I apologize to everyone. So we're just going to talk now about one of the kind of up and coming melanoma markers and just kind of raise our general information threshold about this particular agent, because I think that it is something that is very testable and quite useful and something nice to learn about. So we're going to talk about the research letter here out of the JAAD from 2021 on the diagnostic utility of preferentially expressed antigen in melanoma, that is PRAME, immunohistochemistry in the evaluation of melanoma with a coexistent nevoid melanocytic population, a single study retrospective cohort study. So this is from authors Mia Farah and Hai-Jin Chung from the dermatopathology section of the dermatology department at Boston University School of Medicine and the Department of Dermatology at Harvard Medical School, Boston, Massachusetts. And I like that this notes that this study was presented as an oral abstract at the ASDP meeting virtually in 2020. Having been a fellow who presented at that meeting in the past, I have a special place in my heart for that meeting. So I heart the ASDP. It's a great organization. So here, this is a kind of research letter to the editor where they discuss PRAME, preferentially expressed in antigen in melanoma, which was actually a tumor-associated antigen that was first identified through the analysis of specificity of tumor-reactive T-cell clones that were derived from a patient with metastatic cutaneous melanoma in 1997. So this is something that's been in development for a very long time and is starting to be incorporated more into routine usage.
We talked a little bit about PRAME in episode 52 with Drs. Decker Deacon and Dr. Robert Judson Torres, who came on as guests because they are very interested in melanoma biomarkers, and PRAME is one that they identified as currently a pretty good one, and we made the joke at that point that maybe it's ready for PRAME time, whereas others are not. And nobody, as far as I can tell, knows what it actually does in the body, like what is its physiologic role. It's just a protein that happened to be discovered to be expressed a lot in melanoma and not in other melanocytes. Is that correct?
I looked into this. So there's not a solid understanding of what it does, but many experts think that it's involved in retinoic acid signaling. and specifically that it represses RAR-mediated gene transcription, potentially through the assistance of the EZH2 polycomb group protein, which may be involved in gene silencing. So that is something that they think potentially might be going on here. PRAME is actually very interesting. It is produced not only in cutaneous melanoma, but also found in ocular melanoma and other non-melanocytic malignant neoplasms, including non-small cell lung cancer, breast cancer, renal cell cancer, ovarian cancer, leukemia, synovial sarcoma, and myxoid liposarcoma. Normal healthy tissues don't tend to express it except for testis, ovary, placenta, adrenals, and endometrium. Because of its expression profile, it's considered to be a member of something called the cancer testis antigens, which are expressed only in cancers and specialized tissues such as the testis and placenta. These are attractive agents for immunotherapy because of their limited expression in normal tissues. So that is a nice kind of summation of what it is and what we know about it so far. So it is very useful in looking at melanoma cells. In a previous study from 2018, they kind of looked at the expression of PRAME in different types of melanocytic tumors, and they were able to find diffuse nuclear immune reactivity for PRAME in 87% of metastatic and 83% of primary melanomas. Among melanoma subtypes, it was expressed diffusely and most abundantly in acral melanomas, 94% of those, 92% of superficial spreading melanoma, 90% of nodular melanoma, 88% of lentigo maligna, but only 35% of desmoplastic melanoma. Desmoplastic melanoma really does behave differently than other subtypes of melanoma. It's much more likely to be neurotropic, but less likely to metastasize. And here we see differentiation in the PRAME expression profiles in that specific subtype of melanoma. Non-malignant melanocytic tumors tend to be negative for PRAME. In this study, the previous one, they looked at 140 cutaneous melanocytic nevi. 86.4% were completely negative for PRAME immunoreactivity. And in the remaining percentage of them, they had only a small subpopulation of lesional cells that showed any expression of PRAME. 13.6% of cutaneous nevi, including dysplastic nevi, common acquired and traumatized recurrent nevi, or SPITS. They also note that sometimes you do find it isolated in solar lentigines or benign non-lesional skin. I wonder, though, if that doesn't represent a mutation that is potentially necessary but not sufficient. Like, that's a potential cell that could go on to do something horrific but doesn't have enough other dysregulation of its cellular machinery to get there. I think that it's a, you know, kind of field that we're still learning to understand. But this particular research article looked at the expression of this antigen in nevus-associated melanomas. So these are melanomas that occur in association with a otherwise benign nevus.
Michelle, what percentage of melanomas come from an existing nevus and what are de novo?
So the vast majority are de novo. About 80% are de novo. About 20% are thought to arise from a pre-existing nevus. And in the general population, most of the time, as it is in this study, they are actually the congenital nevus pattern. Not necessarily that the patient was born with it, but the congenital nevus pattern is a histopathologic pattern where you see the melanocytes kind of dissect individually between collagen bundles towards the base of the neoplasm and also kind of swirl around adnexal structures. And that's probably a function of that being one of the most common nevus types in people who do not have dysplastic nevus syndrome. Now, in people who have dysplastic nevus syndrome, the most common nevus for those patients to have a melanoma arise out of is a dysplastic nevus, because they have more dysplastic nevi. So I think it's more of an opportunity thing than a characteristic of the specific tumor. But really only about 20% come out of a pre-existing nevus. So those patients that want to be ritualistically denevused and have every mole in their body removed are not removing their risk of melanoma by a long shot. And I always try to explain that to patients who would like them all removed because they're anxious about each individual mole.
It's good to know. So 20% from a pre-existing nevus.
Yep. So they wanted to look at PRAME antibody as an ancillary marker for the evaluation of nevus-associated melanoma. They looked at all of the nevus-associated melanomas at their institution from 2015 to 2019, and then they recorded patient and tumor characteristics from pathology records. They used the PRAME antibody as a commercially available immunohistochemical stain, and the sections were independently reviewed and scored by two investigators as follows. 0 for no staining, 1+ for staining in 1 to 25% of tumor cells, 2+ for staining between 26 and 50%, 3+ for staining of 51 to 75%, and 4+ for diffuse or greater than 76% of cells. So they really divided them into quartiles. They found 36 nevus-associated melanomas and evaluated all of these. There were 20 males and 16 female patients with a median age of 64 years, ranging from 26 to 83. So no pediatric melanomas in this cohort. 20 of the tumors were on the trunk, 11 on the extremities, 5 on the head and neck. The malignant counterpart included 8 in situ melanomas, 27 invasive melanomas, and 1 dermal melanoma with a median Breslow thickness of 0.6 millimeters, ranging from 0.2 to 3 millimeters. The benign component included 27 dermal and 9 compound melanocytic nevi with a congenital nevus pattern in 14 of those cases. Nuclear staining of melanoma cells was seen in all of the cases, so all of the melanomas had some staining with PRAME. The junctional component showed 4+ expression in 88% of cases. It showed 3+ expression in 6% of cases and 2+ in 6% of cases. So that's for the melanoma component. The invasive melanoma cells had 4+ expression in 93% of cases, in 3+ in 7% of cases. So most of their melanomas were showing good, strong staining. And for the most part, it was in that fourth top quartile of the melanoma area that was staining. So most of the melanomas were staining densely. The nevus counterparts had absent expression in 89% of cases, and in 83% of cases, junctional and dermal components respectively. So that was a good representation of the benignity staining pattern. In the few that did have positive staining for PRAME in the benign component, it was in that bottom quartile, that 1+ expression. PRAME expression in nevus-associated melanomas had been previously reported in individual cases and one recent larger cohort by Lohmann et al., who found that the PRAME differentiated the benign and malignant melanocytic populations in 67% of their nevus-associated melanomas. In this particular study, the pattern of PRAME exposure expression was concordant with H&E assessment, so the cells that looked histologically malignant on routine sectioning also stained malignant with PRAME. Using 4+ as the threshold for melanoma positivity, PRAME was able to distinguish benign from malignant melanocytic populations in 89% of their cases. None of the melanomas had 0 or 1+ PRAME expression, being those lower quartiles, and only 11% of them had the two middle quartiles, so almost all of theirs had highest level expression of PRAME. So I thought that that was very nicely done and, again, solidifies the utility of this particular test. Focal PRAME staining was sometimes seen in benign melanocytes, but this was limited to solitary scattered cells and didn't interfere with the ability of PRAME to distinguish nevus remnants from melanoma. So this could be a valuable adjunct in the evaluation of nevus-associated melanoma, specifically to allow for delineation of Breslow thickness to give better prognostic information for management of the lesions. And as a dermatopathologist, I will say that that is sometimes a difficult call to say, okay, this is where the melanoma begins and this is where it stops. So I think that it could be a very useful study, useful stain to use, and I think it's got good evidence that it's beneficial.
Did you already mention the authors?
I'm not sure, but just in case, Maya Farah and Hai-Jin Chung. I think I did.
Out of Boston University and Harvard, this is from JAD. So I'm not a dermatopathologist, so I just think it's cool that people are excited about this new thing, PRAME, that could hopefully be used to better identify melanomas. So how good is it, Michelle? Is it like the first thing you reach for when you want to do special staining on something you think is a melanoma?
I think it's very useful. I think that it's got better utility than other commonly used stains such as P16 or Ki67. It, of course, could be used in specific cases in combination, especially if you were thinking about somebody that might have some kind of familial syndrome that would affect the expression of those other peptides. And then I think that it also has to be selected properly, remembering the caveat that it's not very good for desmoplastic melanoma, but then again, what is, right? HMB45, MART1 melanate also don't work for desmoplastic melanoma. I always teach my residents that don't buy spindles at the melanate mart because they're no good, okay?
Excellent. So do you normally use P63 and Ki67 before you use PRAME?
P16. P63 I would use more with keratinocytic things. You know, honestly, I think PRAME, when it's available, is a good first line because of its more specific findings. P16, you're looking for an expression of senescence. And, you know, there's some good studies that show us that cells that are behaving themselves in the melanocytic lineage should express P16 as evidence of their senescence as they mature into the dermis. Now, this is different than keratinocytic things, where P16 expression can be a marker for infection with HPV and might actually help you to delineate areas where you have an HPV-induced squamous cell carcinoma. So it's a funny stain because P16 can be like a good thing to find in melanocytic things and a worrisome thing to find in squamous things. It's very interesting protein, and it's quite pimpable, actually. So it basically competitively binds with cyclin-dependent kinase, and it can kind of divert cyclin-dependent kinase away from binding with cyclin so that it can't perform its nefarious work of phosphorylating the retinoblastoma gene product and letting go then of the E2F family of transcription factors, allowing the cell to divide.
Speaking of being nefarious, if I was a nefarious person, do you think I could come up with like some cocktail of stains like P16 and Ki-67 and PRAME and something else and just have artificial intelligence diagnose melanomas?
You know, AI histopathology is something that is on the horizon, and a lot of dermatologists and dermatopathologists are collaborating to try to have a seat at the table to help determine how that technology is used. But I don't know that there is a strict algorithm at this point that would be able to do it with better accuracy than a human.
Especially not you.
That's kind.
Okay, guys, that's all we've got time for today. So today we learned that doxycycline is for more than just acne. It's also for getting rid of eyelid festoons. And we learned what an eyelid festoon is. We learned that you can get allergic contact dermatitis to your AirPods. We learned that you can inject platelet-rich plasma to help androgenetic alopecia. We learned that I feel passionate about isotretinoin laboratory monitoring. And we learned about the PRAME game. Thanks so much for hanging out with us today. Thanks, of course, to our institutions. Thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast. It's an awesome place to work, by the way. And if you are a pediatric dermatologist looking for work, there's a new children's hospital opening up, and we could use some more pediatric dermatologists around here. And thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle. Thanks to Ryan Carlisle, medical student and member of Team Dermosphere, who keeps our social media accounts moving along. Yes, we are super modern and cool. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And we also have a website, dermospherepodcast.com, which is another good place to find us, find our archives, send us a message, and even find a link to our other podcast. Michelle, you want to tell them about our other podcast?
Yes, so we have another podcast. It's called Skincast. It's a much shorter podcast, about 15 minutes, so very biteable content. And this is really for lay people who just want to learn more about how to take the very best care of the skin they're in. So it is, you know, phrased in layman's terms and tried to be very accessible to your general skincare novice.
And if you want to learn more about the Dermy Awards, you can also find those on our website from the previous couple years. And stay tuned, because the 2021 Dermies are coming at you in 2 weeks. We'll see you then.